I'm welcoming back once again conductor Andrew Kohler to preview Saturday night's program from the Kalamazoo Philharmonia. Welcome back.
Thanks so much for having me again.
I'd love to take a minute to look at the recent activities you've had on your calendar, including conducting and playing. It's been an exciting spring.
It's been a very full last month, especially. Yeah. Let's see. A couple weekends ago, that was the final Junior Symphony concert of the year. After that, I had the really lovely opportunity to work with my good friends and colleagues in the Arcato Chamber Ensemble, which is a fully professional group that I put together once in a while, and this time was put together thanks through the help of Corey Summers and the Bach Festival of Kalamazoo. So we sort of kicked off the Bach Festival's week-long celebration, and we did a program in the First Baptist Church with a wonderful countertenor named Terry Barber. That was a really exciting opportunity. And then the same group, ended that Bach Festival by playing the Bach B Minor Mass, at which I had the honor of sitting in the concertmaster chair with those same friends and colleagues. And that was Jim Turner's last performance as music director of the Bach Festival. And the Bach B Minor Mass, of course, is just, as Jim would say, a big sing, you know? I mean, it is an enormous and sort of life-altering work. And yeah, now throughout all that, of course, my mind has been here on the Philharmonia, and now I can turn exclusively towards really getting myself ready and preparing for this concert this Saturday. It's a big one, and it's full of lots of collaborators, a lot of moving parts to this particular program, and that's part of what makes it so exciting.
It'll mark the end of an incredibly demanding and exciting season for you as a conductor.
For sure, yeah. This is kind of the last hurrah of 17, 18. I'm already ahead a year, aren't I? It's 16, 17 this year. That's right. We're always needing to plan a little bit ahead. Yeah, exactly. The final performance of the regular concert season for me. And it's a good one. I've just become, frankly, obsessed with this music. That's often the case for me, but perhaps particularly so. I've titled the program Nightfall, and it's an evocative title, purposefully so, but it fits really well here. It's just two works. We're doing the Nocturnes by Claude Debussy, which were written in the very final days of the 19th century. And then about a decade later, a little over a decade later, Béla Bartók wrote his one and only opera, called Duke Bluebeard's Castle. And it is, frankly, a really thorny work. I will say that the orchestra has had has put up a bit of a fight, I think, with having to learn it. It's been a difficult and challenging time, mostly because it's so hard in an opera, and especially an opera that complicated, to understand the totality of all the parts. Bartók responds so fluidly, so seamlessly to the text throughout the opera, that the usual kind of musical logic that governs, say, a symphony, where you need larger whole-scale repetitions of material and all those things kind of go out the window, because you'll go two bars in this one tempo, and then all of a sudden we lurch into a totally new tonality or a new tempo, and it's constantly speeding up slightly and then slowing down a little bit more. And, you know, he just takes you, it's just hand in glove with what the text is getting for us, which is an amazing experience, I think, ultimately for the listener when all the things are in place. But when you're rehearsing it in those first stages without singers yet, just the orchestra alone, it can be a little baffling as to what it's all about.
Well, our training as musicians often focuses on training us to predict what we're about to see on the page.
Correct. We're always looking ahead when we're reading music, for example, right? We're meant to recognize patterns, always know things that already exist.
And if the next measure has nothing to do with what you thought was coming, it slows you right down.
It does. Yeah. It really does. But I think now is that you know, finally on Monday, we had our wonderful soloist join us. You know, Bluebeard's Castle only really involves two singing roles. That's it in the whole opera. One is Bluebeard himself, and that is a man by the name of David Govertson, who's coming from Chicago, former member of the Ryan Center at Lyric Opera for Rising Stars, and he's done some incredible things. He's sung with the Chicago Symphony and Riccardo Muti, and he's been on stage several times at the Lyric now, singing across from people like Renee Fleming. I mean, just really, yeah. And he's really extraordinary, and just as extraordinary as local soprano Rio Alavace, who is a faculty member at Western and with whom I've collaborated many times, and is just a person that is, she's just a wonderful person and a wonderful soprano. So I always run to her anytime I have a role that seems like it would suit her voice.
Received her training at University of Michigan.
Correct, exactly. And sang in Sarasota Opera, one of the Florida opera companies for a long time, some major roles there too.
Well, in concert order, we begin with the Nocturnes of Claude Debussy, mm-hmm. Which are familiar pieces today. I think, I'm not sure, but why am I thinking of Rite of Spring surprisingness? It's about the same time period, and
yeah, it's
maybe
about,
not obvious how to play them.
It's about a decade earlier or so, and the Nocturnes are, well... So, you know, it's interesting. Bartok is clearly influenced by Debussy. There's no question there. So there's a link there. I can talk a little bit more about when we get to Bartok. But right now, concentrating on Debussy, I think this marks a kind of shift. Really some of the first inklings of modernism you really hear in these scores. As I say, they were completed in December of 1899. So they're often thought of as the last great work of the 19th century. And part of what makes them modern, really, is... the overall approach to music making. I mean, Debussy was always a bit of a firebrand. You know, he was a child prodigy gone wrong, sort of. You know, he was at the Paris Conservatory at 11, but even then, you know, his teachers were sort of shaking their heads at he just didn't seem to listen very much. He liked all these outlandish harmonies, very strange. You know,
take this back and do it again.
Exactly right. Just follow the rules and do what you're told. But he said, I can't help it. I value my freedom too much. I love being able to write what I love. And he had so many disparate influences on his music. That's another thing that makes it so fascinating. Of course, he loved Wagner, but to the casual listener, that's not immediately apparent because he doesn't have any of Wagner's heaviness, any of his extroversion. Instead, what he takes is his sort of ambiguous sense of harmony and the way it can work in different contexts. He also loved the Russian composers. He actually, not everyone knows this, he worked for a little while as a music teacher to the children of Nadezhda von Meck, who was Tchaikovsky's patroness. So he had some real significant contact with Russian music, got to know the music of Mussorgsky, for example. He, of course, at the World's Fair in the late 19th century, got to hear Javanese gamelan, a sort of an ensemble of kind of pitched mellophone instruments and also gongs that uses a different sort of roughly translated pentatonic scale. And he said something beautiful like, it just makes little ghosts of tonic and dominant, which are in Western music sort of the core principles of our tonalities, that it just makes them seem so irrelevant somehow. There's this whole other world of sonority to explore. And so all these things come to bear in his nocturnes. And of course, the other thing is he's frequently thought of as an impressionist, a label that he pushed back against. although one has to say it does seem like it fits pretty well here, especially in these nocturnes. He even, in describing them himself, calls them impressions. And they are inspired by a series of canvases by the same name done by Whistler, the American impressionist. He was also a big fan of Turner, the British painter. And these are just highly evocative images. And one of the ways that I want to place these works, both the Debussy and the Bartok, at the forefront of modernism, not only for all the things I was just saying about Debussy, but also because the 19th century was really quite wrapped up in bigness. You know, things got bigger and bigger and bigger. The orchestras got bigger, the concert halls got bigger, and the themes that tended to attract composers were utterly epic. Epic love and loss. They were about faith and resurrection. They were about great political intrigue and huge political movements and the freedom of man and these sorts of things.
And they were massively stated.
Yes, exactly.
At the beginning of a symphony.
Right, precisely so. And then there's this turn near the end of the 19th century. There's some more pessimism in the air and a turn inward. And I think this is part of what I mean by nightfall. You know, Debussy was turning more inward and he rejected some of that grandiosity. And so these nocturnes are perfect examples of this. He wants just to take a very close look, a painterly look even, you might say, at just a single detail. So the three nocturnes that he writes are called Clouds, and the second one is called Festivals, and the last one is called Sirens, as in the singing creatures of in on the rocks,
right,
in the sea.
Lure the sailors.
Luring sailors, yeah. Right, exactly. And so it's beautiful because they're in different elements, right? One is in the air, one is on earth, and one is on the sea. So he gets to explore those different kind of coloristic possibilities. And in focusing so inward, he really leaves behind a lot of things that you were saying, that we might come to expect as listeners, you know, sort of big repetitions of melody. These things become just sort of wisps, scraps. And instead he focuses a lot on color and a lot on harmony. And it is dizzyingly beautiful. I mean, some of the choices that he makes are just so unexpected. They don't necessarily follow the kind of functional harmony that we expect. You know, there's harmony in Western music often has a tendency to have a particular role, right? This chord wants to lead to this chord, wants to resolve to that, and this one builds tension, this one resolves it, those sorts of things. And he leaves a lot of that behind, just instead opting for the sheer sound of one chord in juxtaposition next to another. But it creates such startling beauty that it really is just utterly arresting to work on and to listen to.
So it would have been surprising to both audiences and the players who are used to their Mahler and Wagner and things. At what point, I know that he dies in 1917, this is less than 20 years after this piece, had he reached his full maturity and sort of philosophy at this point, or is it one of the first pieces in which he's branching out?
No, I mean, I think he's already in his full maturity at this point, because he's already written Prelude to the Afternoon of a Faun, which definitely moves in this direction, in this very symbolist direction. This one is a little bit more painterly, and that one's a bit more poetic, you might say. And within just a few more years, he'll write his greatest orchestral masterpiece, which is La Mer. So he's right in the middle, right in the thick of things, I think.
Does Satie have anything to do with this? I mean, Satie was a bit older than Debussy.
Yeah, I think you know, he has a sort of an influence hanging over a lot of French music, and particularly in this early modern era, and most pointedly in his approach to lightness and his willingness to repeat and his willingness to let go of certain formal conventions in music. So yes, I think that's definitely floating in the air here, as are the clouds of Debussy's first movement.
Shall we give it a listen?
Yes.
Music of Claude Debussy. We heard the opening movement of Nocturnes, the Cloud movement. My guest here is Andrew Kohler, who will open the Kalamazoo Philharmonia concert on Saturday with this work. It begins at 8 p.m. in the Dalton Theater of the Light Fine Arts Center at Kalamazoo College. And I think we set that up rather well, if I dare say. The cloudiness, the atmospheric nature of it, and his non-Germanic writing.
Yeah, it's an astonishing object lesson in how to do so much with so little. I can think of few examples which really are able to say so much with such strictly controlled material, right? I mean, all we really have there are these undulating chords and the strings, a repeating little scrap of melody in the English horn that comes back, and then that lovely flute and harp duet near the end. It's so simple and yet so revolutionary in that way, because it is so simple, because it pushes back against all that bigness that had come before it and just sort of distills like the essence of beauty.
Was this conceived as an orchestral score?
Yes, it was.
Mm-hmm. Debussy was a 50-50 kind of
fellow. Well, actually, at the very earliest stages, I think, he had considered maybe writing a series of works for the Belgian violinist Isai. But somehow that didn't come to fruition. Isai wasn't interested. I'm not really sure exactly what happened in there, but somehow the talks fell apart. And at that point, he just thought, I'll just write for orchestra.
Now we could take a look at the third movement, for which you've invited another smaller group to join the orchestra.
Exactly right. Yeah. So we, another masterstroke here of Debussy, he, again, thinking really broadly about coloristic possibilities in the orchestra, things to add a rather unusual instrument. And I say instrument in this case because it's not, it's a voice, it's voices, and not used in the traditional way. That is to say, this is a wordless chorus. So they're not singing any particular text, but they're all in the female range. It's the soprano and alto voices. And so we've invited our chamber choir from Kalamazoo College's campus. These are all students to sing with us, and they're doing a really wonderful job, and we're really excited about putting it all together finally this Saturday. And obviously, it makes perfect sense why he would have chosen this particular sound, because this last movement set in the sea is Sirene. So these are the sirens sitting on rocks and singing and laughing and playing. As he himself describes it, he also says, and this is situated within a context of the sea, its many rhythms, and the waves silvered by moonlight, as he puts it. Obviously, this is all in keeping with the theme of nocturnes, which themselves, as the name implies, suggests a piece that would be best played at night.
It's hard to fade out on Debussy in Sirene as he takes us away on such a dream, a dream soundscape.
Yeah.
My guest is Andrew Kohler. If you tuned in during that Debussy, we heard music from the nocturnes, the Sirene final movement, Sirens. And to hear it in a room performed right in front of you would allow you to really bask in that color. With each instrument popping out at different parts of the room and the blend of it. And this rehearsals must be enjoyable for this, especially to create that kind of sound as a conductor.
Yeah, I think it's something that one must pay attention to principally, especially in music of Debussy and some of his contemporaries. Because like I say, there's not so much where we can say, oh, the melody needs to be shaped this way or directed this way. I mean, of course, we still think about those things, but they take less prominence than they would, say, in the music of Brahms or something like this. Instead, here we have to think so much about balance and about, you know, whether or not this pairing of flute and oboe is slightly more flute than oboe or slightly more oboe than flute. And those are the sorts of principal concerns that really come, you know, the slight hesitation before recognizing this especially beautiful chord that's coming, you know, just so you make it a really special moment. Those are the sorts of things one ends up thinking a lot about. And we've tried to work very hard on exactly those issues.
How do the nocturnes set you up to perform Béla Bartók's Bluebeard's Castle?
Well, interestingly, Bartók was, you know, it might not seem obvious from a casual listen, but very influenced by Debussy. And Debussy had already written his great opera by this point, the Pelléas and Mélisande. And among the things that was important to Debussy, of course, this sense of color and relative non-action in the plot. I mean, that wasn't one of the things that really drove him, you know, a really sort of overstuffed plot full of stuff. It was more atmosphere as we hear here. And of course, the way he set text was also influenced in turn by the Russians I was mentioning earlier, by Mussorgsky. That is to say that it was very much speech inflected. So he would try and write characteristic rhythms that reflected the way French actually sounded when it was spoken. And all of those things, I think, translated into Bartók's work. Of course, Bartók makes it fully his own, as any great composer would, and injects folk elements into his music, which was something that was particularly important to Bartók, and frankly, a more roughly dissonant texture a lot of times. He was a more strident modernist. Debussy was a bit softer around the edges, you might say, in terms of some of the adventurous harmony that he went for, whereas Bartók opted often for something that jarred a little bit more, and it makes perfect sense in this particular opera. I think, again, to go back to this bigness, this idea of bigness, you know, if Debussy is the twilight, if you will, of that bigness, then Bartók here, even though he is writing for a relatively large orchestra, is writing an opera that is so much about the interior drama of these characters, so much about their psychology. You have to think this is against the backdrop of Freud starting to write about psychoanalysis, this being a new burgeoning field. This inward look, as opposed to the extroversion of the 19th century, this brings us even further inward. And I think it'll be even more clear, not only the title Nocturnes, but then when we hear Bluebeard's Castle, why this concert is called Nightfall, because we really are in the total dark of night by the time we hear Bartók's music.
There's another art term that you're reminding me of from Impressionism. We kind of go into Expressionism.
Mm.
It is a focus on the psychology.
Yes,
yes.
Music. And this is absolutely expressionist. I think that's in fact, to see the original set design by the time that it happened for the first performance of this is very much like looking at a still from, say, a Weimar era film, like The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari or something like that.
Nosferatu.
Exactly, right. And it's very much caught up in that sort of realm. So I'll just briefly recount what this opera is about. So, you know, one of the Mother Goose tales by Charles Perrault was about this duke that married a woman, and she discovers that he has, in fact, killed many of his former wives. So that very basic story, that rather grisly backdrop, is the simple plot line, I suppose you can say, of this opera, but it has been refigured by one of Bartók's contemporaries, a friend of his named Béla Balázs, and turned into a real sort of psychological thriller, a symbolist tour de force that asks us many questions and gives us very few easy answers. We we understand that the former wives of Bluebeard, who are not, in fact, killed in this opera, but are still in his castle, are trapped there in a way. He refuses to make this a simple story of predation. This is something else, something more complicated. This is really asking the question of seen symbolically what we do, what secrets we keep as people, and what when we fall in love, what questions are asked. We think perhaps of love as an opportunity to unburden ourselves of our secrets, you know, but is it real? I mean, when we unburden ourselves, is that mass of still conserved somehow? Does it simply get transferred to someone else, or does it get released away? That's sort of an open question, you know? Can we ever really outlive our own guilt, our own secrets, our own shames? And can love really be a cure-all, as we sometimes hope that it will be? These are the sorts of questions. And I think that's made clear in a prologue that's spoken at the beginning of the opera, or if not clear, at least it invites the question openly in a prologue that's delivered at the beginning of the opera by a character that's only known as the bard. And this is something that's very much in keeping with Hungarian folk storytelling tradition. So Bartok manages to make this both modern and sort of folk-inflected and ancient all at once. And in our particular performance, we're very lucky to have a rather distinguished bard speaking these words, one Carol Laurence, who will say the words of the bard. And one of the things that the bard asks is, where is this happening? Is this outside or within? Which forces us to consider whether or not this scene as a symbolic gesture, all these things that are going on, are not something that we can relate to ourselves. And that's a beautiful thing because, again, on the surface, hearing a story about this duke who maybe kills his wives seems very externalizing. It's unsettling and it's creepy, but you think also, well, that certainly has nothing to do with me. That's just a strange old tale. But when it's rendered into the universal and the psychological, then one starts to ask, can I see something of myself? Is not the violence inherent in all human nature somehow reflected in what's going on here?
There are two song roles.
Correct.
As you mentioned, Rhea Olivace is the soprano.
Yes.
In this performance, representing the new wife.
Exactly right. Whose name is Judith in this opera.
And the very experienced baritone David Govertson will sing Bluebeard. My question, did they have to, were these roles already in their repertoire?
No.
No.
They were not. This is something that's, again, because it's only two characters and because so much of it is an interior kind of psychological drama that's often done very successfully in a concertant staging. That is to say, it's either semi-staged, it's not fully staged, but neither of them had done this before. So it was a big leap of faith for them to take on this project. But they were both, I think, as excited as I was to get, roll up the sleeves and get into this incredible and sometimes infrequently done music.
Well, I really want to get into the music, but I just had a final question of how it was received when it was first premiered.
He actually wrote it for a competition, an opera, a one-act opera competition, and it was rejected outright because it had not nearly enough drama in it. It wasn't dramatic enough, they said, which is absurd on the face of it. They meant in terms of a classical sense of drama, you know, plot sort of driving the action, and that there were only two characters, and so that was insufficient. So they wanted no part of it. Bartok was very soured on the experience, and it wasn't until he had produced some other works, ballet works like The Miraculous Mandarin, that he had started to make a larger reputation for himself, and then finally somebody came back and said, oh, let's look at this earlier work of yours. And then, about a decade after he had written it, it started to get premieres. He actually despaired of ever hearing it performed in the first place. There's a lovely letter he wrote to his wife where he said, you know, I'll just play it for you a little bit at the piano and we'll mourn its loss because I don't think I'll ever be able to hear this out, you know, properly played by the orchestra. But since then, it has been played many times and people have recognized the truly awesome power of this story and of his, as I was mentioning earlier, extremely flexible music. I mean, it's just music that responds so in the moment to everything that happens. The plot, such as it is very straightforward. Judith arrives in Bluebeard's castle and sees that everything is dark in there. And she sees seven closed doors. And she immediately wants to know what's behind those doors. He demurs, says, please don't ask questions. Just love me. Be here with me, you know? And she says, but we must let light into your castle, right? We must see, you know, there's no, it's so dark, it's so gloomy in here. We must allow some sunshine. So reluctantly, one by one, he starts to give her keys to these various doors. And one by one, she opens these doors and is sometimes shocked and surprised by what she sees. In the first doors, we're introduced to Bluebeard's violent nature. And we see a torture chamber in the first one and a armory in the second one. And then we see his more poetic nature in the next three doors. We're introduced to his sort of treasure a chamber, you know, full of gold. And then we see a beautiful sort of secret garden in the next door. And then the final one is a really amazing moment in the opera. It's everything, the expanse of his entire kingdom. Somehow one door opens and you can see everything. So light floods in, yeah? In all those cases, though, she keeps noticing, after being sort of wowed by the beauty of what she's seeing in those last three doors, that when she takes a closer look, there's blood on the flowers of the garden. There's blood on the jewels. And somehow a cloud casts a bloody shadow on his great expansive kingdom. And then she really pushes. She wants to know what the last two doors is behind the last two doors. And he really resists here. And then finally, she prevails and finds that there's a lake of tears behind the sixth door. And by this time, she's more or less figured it out. She keeps referencing the whispered rumors, and she says, your wives, your former wives, those whom you have loved before me, they are behind the seventh door. And he finally admits that, yes, they are. But she's surprised to learn that they're alive. And indeed, what he sings to them is not, you know, again, not a simple tale of predation. He instead sings kind of an homage to each one of them. He says, this is the one I found at morning, you know, this one, all the mornings are hers forever. And sort of salutes each one of these wives and says that they are responsible for watering his garden, for the beauty of his castle, you know, for everything that he has there. Everything that he has there is theirs. Hmm. And then he eventually turns to Judith and says, now you join them.
Yeah.
And then she resists initially, but then sort of goes to join the other three former wives. And Bartok, I keep saying Bartok because it seems so much like he's reflecting himself, but I, of course, mean Bluebeard, is left alone in darkness once again in his castle.
Oh, it's quite stifling, this story. There's a lot of...
It's amazing. And I can think of relatively few precedents where music is so overtly unsettling, you know? I mean, there's certainly many emotions that music is capable of making us feel. But this one really asks us to sort of face discomfort. So maybe we can listen to a little bit of the opening of this, and then perhaps if time allows, skip to something like the opening of the fifth door, which is the exact midpoint of the opera and is a really extraordinary moment.
Once upon a time, where did this happen? Outside or within? Ancient fable. What does it mean, ladies and gentlemen? The song goes on. You look at me. My eyes are on you. The curtain of our eyelids is raised. Where is the stage, outside or within?
Cadet, a carriage car got seas, Tesh here back at Lovanier Hill, you did gerse, make you tarum.
Well, we've heard the opening of Bluebeard's Castle by Béla Bartók and Andrew Kohler will conduct. We've been listening to a recording sung in Hungarian.
Yeah.
What will happen on Saturday?
Well, we've decided that in order to communicate this text as immediately as possible to our audience that we will sing in English. Also, relatedly, Hungarian is a very complicated language. despite the fact that so many of these rhythms are characteristic of Hungarian speech, there's a translation by Peter Bartok, the composer's son, that we're using, a newer one, one that does change some of the rhythms but preserves many of them and tries to find ways to render it into relatively idiomatic English. We've made a few tweaks of our own in addition to that, but we're hoping that we can really get across the content of this in with greater immediacy.
What I heard was unsettling. It just set up this sense of worry,
foreboding.
For it.
Yes. Yeah. And that's exactly an unbelievably sustained atmosphere throughout the entirety of this opera. Yet there are moments of great openness, of great warmth. I think these characters really, I think we are meant to understand that Bartok hears these characters as truly loving one another. Yeah. So this is not, again, simply somebody taking advantage of the other, right? There is genuine love that they seem to have for one another, and they're just not quite able to meet and understand one another on a psychological level. So there's great romanticism. There's more folk-inflected elements. You heard a little bit of that at the beginning, and there's more coming up soon. There's so much to say about this incredible work, and I know we're very short on time. I just really hope that people will join us on Saturday, because this is such a wonderful collaborative undertaking and something that has such, I think, incredible resonance for all of us, because it's something that is happening, I think, just as much within as it is happening outside.
Well, I'll be there, and I think it's going to be a wonderful concert.
Well, thank you, and I hope others will join us this Saturday at 8. And maybe just to give a little sense of the contrast, or a totally opposite kind of atmosphere that happens at one point. I mentioned the fifth door is the expanse of his entire kingdom, and Bartok writes suitably expansive music for that. And maybe we can listen to that as we go out.
Thank you, Andrew.
Thank you, Kara.